Chen and I would like to begin this week's episode by acknowledging the death of Queen Elizabeth II on Thursday, the UK's longest reigning monarch. Her 70-year reign was characterized by unwavering public service and a commitment to her role as the constitutional monarch. And there was no better illustration of that than when she invited Liz Truss to form a government and become her 15th Prime Minister just 2 days before her passing. Our deepest sympathies extend to her family at this time and to the new King, Charles III. God save the King.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Ballot to Talk About. It is Saturday, the 10th of September, 2022, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Sam. Now, Sam, there's been a lot of events happening over the last week, but you and I also are sports fanatics as well. This weekend is the US Open Final. As I know you are a massive tennis fan from my time spent over the summer with you, do you want to bet on the winners?
Oh, tough question. Tough question. I mean, interestingly, this tournament started all about Serena Williams and her retirement, and that was a seismic moment for tennis. And it started about her. She went out. Everybody was then talking about Rafael Nadal. Neither of those people are in this final weekend, and yet I think it's going to be action-packed this weekend, because on the women's side we have the world number one and the world number two facing off against each other, which is excellent. It's always great when that happens. And I think Iga Swiatek, the world number one, will just edge that one. Men's side, we now have a final between two of the next generation, Casper Ruud, Carlos Alcaraz, which will not only be a battle for their respective first Grand Slam, but also a direct battle for the world number one ranking as well. So, I mean, that's going to be great. And my money would be on Carlos Alcaraz, but who knows? But I think it's great to see the future of tennis coming through in this tournament, which all began about the past.
Well, yeah, I mean, considering as well that you and I were brought out the era, particularly on the men's side with the big four, Murray, Djokovic, Nadal, Federer, and then all of a sudden, yeah, we have two people in the final who, frankly, as a bit lesser observer of tennis,
yeah,
had to Google a little bit, really.
And, I mean, put it this way, Serena Williams won her first Grand Slam in 1999. I mean, we had barely been born at that point. I mean, it's astonishing, really.
Well, yes, it is an astonishing weekend coming out in the US Open as well, but it's also been an astonishing week in the United Kingdom as well, where not only has there been expected political news with the change of our prime minister, but it's also been, as you wonderfully opened up this episode, the death of the head of state, Queen Elizabeth II, which has, I think, if you had asked people at the start of the week on Wikipedia, they put the head of state and head of government to see both King Charles III and Liz Truss MP, I think you would fathom a lesser chance of that happening. I mean, you know, sometimes news, there's slow news days and suddenly there's news all at once, and this certainly feels like it. Anyway, this week's episode will break down the elections of Liz Truss as the leader of the Conservative Party and the 56th Prime Minister of the UK, having been appointed 2 days before Her Majesty the Queen passed away as her 15th Prime Minister. We will also be looking ahead to the upcoming Italian general election that will be taking place on Sunday, the 25th of September, analysing the events that led to the snap poll and the major parties and coalitions itself. But first, Sam, let's begin with the appointment of a new prime minister. So take us through the political events that took place this over the last week.
Yeah, so on Monday, we had the chair of the 1922 committee, Graham Brady, announce that Liz Truss had been elected as the new Conservative Party leader following the members' ballot, and she defeated former Chancellor Rishi Sunak by 57.4% to 42.6%. Then on Tuesday, She travelled to Balmoral to receive the invitation from the Queen to form a government before returning to London to appoint her new cabinet. And as of now, recording, we have the full cabinet and an overwhelming majority of all ministerial appointments. I think we're just waiting on some lower tier ministers and the parliamentary private secretaries as well. Wednesday, Liz Truss held her first Prime Minister's Questions. And on Thursday afternoon, her big, what was supposed to be her enormous energy price package was announced in the Commons. Well, that debate was then interrupted to bring her the news that Her Majesty the Queen was gravely ill. And then by the afternoon, Liz Truss was then, her week was transformed and she was about to lead national mourning. And by Friday afternoon, she was then holding her first audience with the King. So it's been quite a week for observers of British politics, and I'm sure for Liz Truss herself as well. Just to talk you through a few of the key cabinet appointees, the major offices of state. So her Chancellor of the Exchequer, Kwasi Kwarteng, he'd been business secretary since 2021. In the Foreign Office, we have James Cleverly, who is a former party chairman. Home Secretary Suella Braverman, who was the Attorney General in Boris Johnson's outgoing government and was also a former leadership contender in this race. Defence Secretary is the continuation of Ben Wallace in that post that he's held since the start of Boris Johnson's premiership. And finally, the Health Secretary and Deputy Prime Minister, Therese Coffey, who had been Work and Pension Secretary and a very close ally of Liz Truss. And in fact, she has almost a neighbouring constituency to Liz Truss down in Suffolk. So you can see a full list of cabinet appointees and a highlights reel of ministerial appointees on our Twitter. And I'm sure, Churn, as we go through this first half, we'll be bringing up some of them throughout our discussion. But my first question to you was, what were your initial reactions to the results? One, was it a surprise? And two, the margin, were you surprised at the margin of victory for Liz Truss?
First of all, I wasn't surprised by the outcome. I mean, all the polls consistently had shown that Liz Truss would comfortably defeat Rishi Sunak. And you and I think, kind of got bored of the Conservative leadership election, in large part because we knew who was going to win. And whilst it had so many more weeks to go, we realised the enormous intrigue that she was going to have and just wanted to get on with it. Well, her intrigue had suddenly landed an unexpectedly increase on Thursday. But I would like to, the margin, I have to say, was on the smaller side than you had been expecting. Sam and I exchanged messages about an hour or two before the actual result was due to be announced, asking us to predict a last-minute prediction of the result. And I say about 62, 63, which was something I think you mentioned either. And it turns out, I think, that there was quite an overestimate by the opinion polls, because if you look at YouGov, Opinium was probably the most accurate, but they all thought that Liz Truss would have a 6 in front of it. And this turned out to be the tightest margin of a leadership election for the Conservative Party since the rule was changed. In fact, even lower than Ian Duncan-Smith. And we know how his tenure ended as opposition leader. So, Seb, I just wanted to ask this thought experiment where, and I know that I didn't put this down in initial thinking of questions, was if the opinion polls had been more accurate, that predicted a much tighter race, or let's say the error had been the other way, where it was 55-45, do you think that would have any impact on the race or put more scrutiny on Liz Truss? Because everyone sort of went to bed because they knew that she was going to win and win pretty comfortably. What was the impact, if you think it was a bit more of an accurate reflection?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is an interesting thought experiment and we'll never really know. But I think a lot of the opinion polls that we were basing our understanding of the contest on were conducted earlier on in the race. So just after the ballot papers had dropped in the hands of Conservative Party members. And I think at that stage, it was an accurate reflection of opinion, because my sense of the contest is that as the contest went on, particularly in the middle part, There was a moment of doubt about Liz Truss's plans, and Rishi Sunak was gaining, I wouldn't go as far to say momentum, because he was never really seen as someone who's going to win the contest, but I think his opinions were gaining a bit more traction, and as they went around the country, they could see that his thoughts were going down pretty well with Conservative Party members. So I think that's sort of where it came from, this slightly narrower margin than we expected. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, Liz Truss still won by 15%, so it was quite a large victory. The thought experiment is interesting. I feel like had the race looked narrower earlier on, I do think Rishi Sunak could have pushed this contest much tighter, because I think one of the things that was counting him out was that people thought, oh, well, it doesn't matter if I prefer the opinions of Rishi Sunak because he's not going to win anyway. And yet it turned out to be a lot closer than we thought. So, yeah, it's interesting to think.
Yeah, it really is. And you're right. The answer is we'll never know. And I think, you know, over the days and months to come, we will see what the Liz Truss premiership will look like. But after the appointment on Monday's leader, on Tuesday, she began to form her cabinet. So Sam, let me start with you. If you look at the appointment list of the cabinet, what appointments do you stood out?
I think on the whole, this cabinet wasn't hugely surprising, because there'd been quite a number of briefings prior to the actual appointments being made of what we expected the cabinet to look like, and almost to the position, it was pretty much as expected. Certainly in the top positions in the cabinet were pretty routine. So one that did catch me slightly off guard was Therese Coffey being given the title of Deputy Prime Minister. There had been some rumours of that prior to it happening, but I'd always thought that she would potentially opt for someone who is, how do you say it, slightly more charismatic than Therese Coffey, given that one of the chief duties of Deputy Prime Minister in this modern age of politics is to partake in Prime Minister's questions when the Prime Minister is either out of the country or incapacitated. And I'm looking forward to seeing Therese Coffey face Angela Rayner at the dispatch box. I think it's not particularly a match that we're used to. But I think if I were to take a step back, one of my big surprises was that for the first time ever, we have no white males in any of the four great offices of state for the first time, which is not surprising, but it's new. And that is a great step forward, even if some of the positions held by those people are less than favourable towards other members of the global majority. And also at 23%, this is the highest ever proportion of people from the global majority for a first cabinet of a prime minister, which is also a notable fact as well. So those are good things. Fun story for you, though, which I thought was quite funny, is that Nadeem Sahawi has now become the second shortest-serving chancellor of all time. Do you know who the shortest-serving chancellor of all time is?
Oh, that's a good question. Who is it?
So it is Ian MacLeod, who was appointed Chancellor of the Exchequer by Ted Heath in 1970 and only served for 30 days because he quite suddenly died. So Nadeem Sahawi is the shortest serving chancellor who didn't pass away in office. So there's a fun fact for you.
Well, that's a great fun fact. I think in my case, I just like to point out that of the top posts, I think this is the first time in British history where both the Prime Minister and Deputy Prime Minister are women, which is, I think that's historic, actually. So that is a step forward. There are 8 women serving in the full cabinet rank in this cabinet. The other women include Suella Braverman, as you said, Home Secretary, Health. Penny Mordaunt, a former leadership contender, is the leader of the Commons, and Lord President of the Council, which, as we were discussing before we started recording, has turned out to be a much more important post than I think Liz Truss thought that when she appointed her to that position. Kemi Badenoch, another former leadership contender, is a new international trade secretary. Chloe Smith, if you remember back to the days of Norwich North by-election, which was the first by-election I can certainly remember when I was politically active, has made it as work and pension secretary. So quite a new influx of women. And of course, Michelle Donnellan. How could we ever forget about Michelle Donnellan? Well, she's really made history. She's served longer as culture secretary right now than education secretary. So there's some new women that have been added into this cabinet, which has been very interesting indeed. But I would like to draw your attention to Penny Morden, because she did pretty well. She got nearly a third of MP support, just behind Liz Truss. But yet, she's gotten a cabinet position as leader of the House, which is lesser in importance compared to Cammy Badenoch or Sueda Braverman, who all were knocked out in earlier rounds of the leadership contest. Why do you think that is the case? Because she has quite a strong following in the Conservative Party, doesn't she?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of reports were saying that Penny Mordaunt was gunning for Foreign Secretary as a role, particularly looking at her defence background and her foreign policy experience. I think for Liz Truss, it was important to have Penny Mordaunt in the cabinet. And I actually think Leader of the House of Commons is quite a good move from Liz Truss, because Penny Mordaunt is a very good performer in the House of Commons, and Leader of the House of Commons is not someone who necessarily gets involved in policy debates, but they are quite often holding court in the House of Commons. They are reading out the business, responding to general business questions, and I think Penny Mordaunt will excel in that position. But equally, from Liz Truss's assessment of Penny Mordaunt as someone to watch out for, it's not too prominent a position that she could be parading around the world stage, kind of doing what Liz Truss was doing in the last cabinet, to be frank, and marketing herself as a leader in waiting. That's not something that you will be able to do as successfully in the Leader of the House of Commons than you could in Foreign Secretary, where you spend a lot of your time outside of the country talking to other world leaders, talking to counterparts from all around the world, and creating a personal brand as such. So I think it's a tactical move, but also one that does work in Liz Truss's favour in terms of cabinet performers.
Yeah, I mean, you just have to look on YouTube to some of her notable performances in the House of Commons, and I think there indeed lies the talent that Penny Mordaunt has. I do think that it struck me with Penny Mordaunt that it's also how it parallels to what Theresa May did to Andrea Leadsom. Because she, don't forget, Theresa May defeated Andrea Leadsom. Yes, she was Environment Secretary, but she spent majority of the May premiership from 2017 to 2019 as Leader of the House of Commons. And it was arguably Andrea Leadsom's resignation as Leader of the Commons that finally brought down Theresa May. So slight little parallel of history that I think Liz Truss should potentially be aware of when as the position Leader of the House. And I think my final comment on Penny Mordaunt is that sometimes Leader of the House is not a full cabinet rank. It sometimes be one of those that is attending cabinet, because there's a limit on based on pay, on the number of legislation, on the number of full cabinet ministers. Penny Mordaunt as Leader of the House has been given full cabinet rank. So I think that is one thing that has distinguished herself from some of her predecessors.
Yeah, I mean, the other big question for me when we talk about Penny Mordaunt is the other leadership rival, Rishi Sunak, is clearly not in this cabinet. There were some suggestions that he was offered roles. I heard health being batted around in the build-up to Liz Truss's election as leader. But in terms of the broader reshuffle, have there been olive branches given to the Sunak camp more generally? Or do you see this as just a consolidation of existing Truss allies?
Yeah, that is a very good question. What has happened to the fate of Rishi Sunak supporters? I think my answer is twofold. Firstly, if you look at the cabinet list itself, so those in cabinet or attending cabinet, I think it's very clear that she has adopted a Boris Johnson playbook of terms of filling it with her close supporters. You know, she and Kwasi Kwarteng wrote that infamous book, who's a Chancellor of Exchequer, wrote the infamous book called Britannia Unchained in 2012. And they are reportedly been very close politically. And it's no surprise that I think that he was appointed Chancellor. I think similar to James Cleverly, they have also been, he was a noted Truss ally particularly from the very start of the leadership contest. So she does seem to have followed the playbook to fill the cabinet with a lot of those who have supported Liz Truss. And nonetheless, I think it's significant, however, that the only person in the cabinet and attending cabinet who has supported Rishi Sunak is the only one of them, is the newly appointed Attorney General Michael Ellis. So it suggests to me that this is very much that. However, she's also Dr. Boris Johnson's other playbook, which is, if you recall, in the last cabinet, not the caretaker one, but he appointed people like Penny Morden as trade minister, Damien Hines as security minister, i.e. very capable number twos were not necessarily his supporters. I see Liz Truss doing some of this. We haven't seen the full list yet because the reshuffle has understandably been interrupted because of what's been going on in with the death of Her Majesty the Queen. But for example, Robert Jenrick, who was a prominent Rishi supporter, is the Minister of State at Health, the number two under Therese Coffey. So I can see some of that playbook where you stack the cabinet with supporters, but potentially competent Rishi supporters in the number two positions playing out in this reshuffle. Do you buy that theory?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you do see them in lower ministerial ranks. You've got Mark Spencer, you have Robert Jenrick, all receiving ministerial posts. But it did strike me as interesting that given that Liz Truss's margin of victory was smaller than most people were expecting, I'm sure lower than she was expecting, that she didn't make more of a concerted effort to bring Sunak allies into the cabinet, because I think you are at risk, because Rishi Sunak clearly had quite a passionate following. He presented quite a starkly different ideological platform to Liz Truss. There does seem to me the worrying potential from a Liz Truss perspective that you now have a sizable number of MPs on the backbenches who openly disagree with you, in a position where they have no real incentive to remain loyal to you because they're not bound by collective ministerial responsibility and they don't see significant olive branches being offered out to bring them into the fold. So it's a risky move by Liz Truss. It was a risk that Boris Johnson took that ultimately didn't pay off a few years down the line, but that was a lot of his own making. But it is a risk.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. I think one more thing I would like to ask you about this cabinet is the post of education secretary. Now, education, as we know, has had a lot of problems in the pandemic. Remember Gavin Williamson as education secretary not too long ago. And it is going to be, you know, education attainment is going to be one of the key issues moving forward, particularly the disproportionate education attainment coming out of recovery. There were a lot of names banded around for education secretary. I saw Kemi Badenoch's name being banded for education. Michelle Donnellan was as well. But it ultimately went to Kit Malthouse. Your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, Kit Malthouse becomes the fifth education secretary in the last 12 months. Chern, quick question. Can you name them?
Kit Malthouse, Michelle Donnellan, James Cleverly, Nadeem Zahawi. And before Zahawi, was it Williams? No, what was before? Williamson?
Gavin Williamson. It was that long ago. But yeah, fifth education secretary in a year, which is astonishing for any ministerial position, let alone one that's considered quite prominent in the cabinet. But I mean, my reaction to Kit Malthouse is that he is a relatively experienced cabinet minister. He was a close ally of Boris Johnson going way back to the London mayoralty. He has general frontline politics experience. He wasn't necessarily a name that I pictured going into that portfolio. I don't know what his education policy experience is. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But what does slightly concern me is that it feels like education has become a portfolio that is an afterthought and given as a reward to someone who had been an ally of Boris Johnson and Liz Truss, rather than some thinking, oh, this person could make a significant impact in the policy of education, which, as you correctly cited just there, is going to be quite an important policy house in the post-COVID recovery, cost of living crisis, energy crisis. And now that we're rebuilding back up to regular assessment and attainment as well. So that is my only concern, is that it does feel like, have a cabinet post, oh, education.
It's a bit like how traditionally we associate people who appointed transport secretaries or DCMS secretaries. I think we have to update the number of people who have been DCMS secretaries since the Conservatives came to power. And we do know that Stuart Andrew has been sacked. So there'll be another housing minister and yet to be named. I just thought there was another fun fact that I realized as well, looking at this cabinet list. Suella Braverman, Kwasi Kwarteng, James Cleverly, Kit Morehouse, just four of them, have all stood or been elected to the London Mayoral, London Assembly. So it clearly seems that seems to be one quite good pipeline of how we can get into this Conservative cabinet.
A final point on the cabinet, really, before we move on to talk about Liz Truss's first few acts as Prime Minister, is the relative experience of the cabinet, because I did see some interesting research conducted in tandem with the New Statesman about ministerial or shadow ministerial experience of senior ministers in the cabinet. The average ministerial experience of these senior cabinet ministers is 58 months. That is compared to the second lowest previously, which was Ted Heath at 68. But recent history, you had Johnson's government 79, May's government 78, Blair 85, Brown 95, Cameron 98. So this is a relatively inexperienced cabinet in terms of ministerial and shadow ministerial experience, which, given the size of the entry, is quite something, isn't it?
Well, just a note on the Cameron stat. I wonder what happens when you take out Ken Clark. What happened to that cabinet statistic? So I think let's put a caveat on the Cameron stat. But you're right, this is an inexperienced cabinet. And I think it really is comparing it against what Gordon Brown, who kind of came into power in 10 years or 10, 11, or, you know, after 10 years of the same party government, same as Liz Truss, but the churn is so much within the Conservative Party. And one that we see is that each leader of the Conservative Party wants to bring their own people. And we've had four prime ministers that inevitably you had lots of chopping and changing of people who, you know, have only served a very few period of time. Now, that has meant that you are getting ministers on training wheels, essentially, learning the job. And Liz Truss has quite an ambitious reform agenda. So the question is one that we've often seen, and Liz Truss wants to tackle this idea of, you know, group thinking or the Treasury orthodoxy, as we've seen as him, Kwasi Kwarteng, firing the permanent secretary of the Treasury, is that you could get civil servants running the show rather than secretaries of state who are building up experience and building up knowledge in a new policy areas. Like you said, equivalent to Kit Morehouse, who has never served in education roles in his previous term in the London Assembly, nor has had any junior ministerial roles throughout his time as education secretary. So I think that will be very interesting indeed. So you could argue that, well, Suella Braverman, as a former lawyer, you know, home secretary, sort of relative synergy to that. James Cleverly, he of course was trade minister, while foreign minister in a junior foreign minister, you know, that he seems well suited to serving as Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs. You know, Brendan Lewis, again a former lawyer, has been put as justice. So it seems the top post seems to be a round peg with a round hole, but nonetheless these are still new topic areas, and I think something in which that that will mean a lot of challenges for this incoming government as well. One thing I'd just like to end this remarks on, Sam, is what you think is remarkable that Liz Truss was only elected in 2010, the same year the Conservatives came to power, and yet she's now Prime Minister 12 years later, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, had Rishi Sunak have won, he was only elected in 2015. So yeah, I mean, as I said, that inexperience stems all the way up to the top, because, I mean, Liz Truss has held numerous posts within the cabinet, but in terms of general MP experience is relatively low compared to previous prime ministers. But Just to round off this section, Chern, firstly, we had the seismic breaking news that we were talking about. Secondly, it took first 24 hours talking about the energy announcement and her first Prime Minister's questions. What's the gauge we get of Liz Truss's first few weeks, months, years of her premiership? How will it differ to Boris Johnson? And do we expect this week's breaking news to have changed that at all?
Well, it's completely drowned out her energy announcement, despite 150 billion it being cost. I think Liz Truss throughout the campaign knew her audience was that was Conservative Party members, but the size of the energy package, the level of state interventions suggests to me a level of pragmatism in terms of how you govern the country, because it's quite seismic, the amount of money the government is spending to try and, you know, and try and bring costs of relief to millions of Britons. Now, there is some ideology in this, in the fact there is no windfall tax attached to it. But nonetheless, I think it does show there is a pragmatic streak through her. And I think it could explain how she survived in the Cameron, May and Johnson administrations, really. She's the longest serving continuous cabinet minister, having served in cabinet since 2014. And so there is that level of pragmatism as well, and reflected in the cabinet, in the final cabinet position. I'd like to highlight, to further back up my point, is the fact that, yes, she appointed Jacob Rees-Mogg as Secretary of State for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. But tellingly, she has appointed Graham Stewart as the Minister for Climate. And I think that is to allay the fears of a certain number of the moderate Tory MPs that look at Jacob Rees-Mogg and do not think that he is sufficiently pro-net zero or in helping to take the necessary legislation and the necessary steps to bring the country to net zero. I think it's an acknowledgement of the political realism that does resist, that does exist within Liz Truss. And I think she has clearly spent quite a lot the last number of weeks, you know, working out what went wrong with the Boris Johnson premiership, which I think is lots of talk, but not much delivery. I think that if not for the breaking news, which will consume the government over the next 2 weeks, it did show that she wants to deliver. And I suspect that's a message that she ran home, particularly on the steps of number 10, and she would have wanted her government to start it off with.
No, I think you're absolutely right on all of those points. It does seem like she was attempting to get out of the gates very quickly on big pledges. I mean, to put this into context, furlough was considered one of the largest government expenditures ever, costing estimated around £70 to £80 billion. The energy package that Liz Truss proposed on Thursday morning is roughly estimated to be around £150 billion. So this commitment was going to be enormous. And obviously we know that it was then interrupted unexpectedly by the news that broke on Thursday afternoon. But I mean, we that just gives you an impression of some of the policies that Liz Truss is going to try and put through. And we knew from the leadership campaign, we talked about this before, that her monetary policy was going to mark a stark difference between the Boris Johnson government and the incoming government. And we'll await to see how that's put into practice. Obviously, that's all on hold at the moment, and could be for quite some time, because after the national period of mourning, it's the government's responsibility to arrange the coronation, to arrange general accession. There will be an investiture ceremony to arrange for Prince William to become Prince of Wales. There's all these kinds of things in combination with the delivery of the energy plan and further solutions on the cost of living as well. So, I mean, we talked about the size of Liz Truss's entree, but it just got a whole lot bigger and a whole lot more time pressured than we ever expected it to be. So time will tell.
So welcome back to Ballot to Talk About. So in the next half of this episode, we'll be fast forwarding to the 25th of September, where 8 months earlier than scheduled, Italians will hit the polls to elect 400 members of the Chamber of Deputies, which is their lower house, and 200 members of the Senate, the upper house, and is excluding some senators for life. So just a quick recap of this last term in government, because by Italian standards, it's been quite rocky. Outside viewers anyway, it's seen two governments led by Giuseppe Conte, who led the Five Star Movement, a populist government between, the first one was a populist government led between the Five Star Movement and Liga. The second was a Five Star Movement led government with the center-left Democratic Party. That collapsed, and it led to a grand coalition of all the main political parties, with the one notable exception of the far right to the right wing to far right Brothers of Italy, led by the former ECB president Mario Draghi. And his government was brought down due to a split in the Five Star Movement, with the remnants of the Five Star Movement, including its now party leader Giuseppe Conte, pulling out of the unity government, triggering Draghi's resignation. Now, President Sergio Mattarella rejected his first resignation, but his second resignation was approved after the Senate failed to pass a confidence vote of an absolute majority after defections from the Five Star Movement, Liga, and Forza Italia, which is led by the former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. Yep, he still is in Italian politics and is running for the Senate this time round. So the main contenders is a coalition of centre-left parties led by the Democratic Party, led by former Prime Minister Enrico Lecce, and several allies, including Civic Commitment, which is led by the foreign minister and former Five Star Movement leader, Luigi Di Maio. Lecce is expected to be the prime minister candidate for this alliance. On the center right, it is comprised of three main political parties, which are the Brothers of Italy, led by Giorgia Meloni, Liga, which is led by the former interior minister, Matteo Salvini, and Forza Italia, led by Silvio Berlusconi. The understanding within the alliance is that whoever gains the most number of votes will become prime minister should it win. And based on the opinion polls, that will be Meloni. If she was successful, will be Italy's first female prime minister. So it could be quite a significant month for women, because tomorrow Swedes go to the polls, and you can watch our preview episode from last week. You know, Liz Truss has just been appointed prime minister, and Italy could be about to see its first female prime minister. So quite a significant moment for women heads of government. We should note that the Five Star Movement is running alone on this election, led by Giuseppe Conte, alongside Italia Viva, who is Team of Action, and Italia Viva is led by former Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. So, Sam, you're going to tell me an interesting stat about Italian Prime Ministers that I'm looking forward to later on. But what have been the main issues that have been dominating this election campaign?
Yeah, I mean, the key issue that we can see from this campaign really seems to be all around immigration, asylum, and race. And that's largely motivated by the fact that one of the main contenders in this race is the Brothers of Italy, who have made that the forefront of their campaign and the forefront of what has made them such a prominent political party in Italy. And there were two key events, really, that inflamed this and made this even more prominent. So firstly, we had the murder of Alika Ogorchukwu, a Nigerian migrant. And in the aftermath of that, you had progressive parties accusing the right of propagating racist propaganda that caused the murder. And then you had the right accusing the left of appropriating the murder for political campaign purposes. Fast forward a week, the leader of the Brothers of Italy, Giorgia Meloni, tweeted a video of a rape of a Ukrainian woman by a Guinean asylum seeker, and it was eventually taken down by Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram due to content violations, but nonetheless stirred up the campaign and once again had the left and the right arguing over whether it was appropriation or whether it was caused by racist propaganda. And then you even had then a councillor of La Liga from Florence filmed a video stating that a vote for League was a vote to deport Roma people. So this is the tone of the campaign. This is what the campaign has all been about. It's been about race, immigration, asylum. And obviously, the cost of living is a major issue and has been in this Italian election. There have been huge debates over how to attribute EU COVID recovery funds. But nonetheless, I think at the heart of this campaign is quite a severe debate on race, asylum, and immigration that has permeated through every single policy discussion in this campaign. I don't know if you think that's a fair assessment, Chern.
I think that's a very fair assessment. And don't forget that immigration has been a perennial problem for the last few elections in Italy itself. Matteo Salvini in the 2018 election also picked out on the theme of immigration and illegal asylum seekers by boat as his, some of his pledges as well. I think, however, this idea of using immigration is classic far-right playbook in terms of trying to pin people's frustrations with their general cost of living issues and their standard of living onto something quite so tangible as that, or trying to find a common enemy. I think in the past, if you in the early 2010s, it was probably frustration with the European Union. But in recent years, that has morphed more into immigration. And, you know, the context is, of course, seeing rising energy prices all throughout Europe itself. And I think we are just seeing the right, I think, using, you know, Giorgia Meloni, however vile some people might think, is clearly work, because the last couple of weeks, we've seen an increase in the Brothers of Italy opinion polls. And I think that that has really, to me, shown that they just, Italians are in frustrated and in the mood for change. Don't you think so?
Yeah, and I mean, we've seen in the past, I'm thinking just the UK as an initial example, is that at times when people's belts are tightened even further, when you're going through recession, when you're going through cost of living crises, it's a perfect storm for these kind of right-wing opinions, because they can attribute blame, they can talk about why cost of living is made even worse by policies like more open-door immigration, accepting further asylum seekers. So you do often see a correlation around the world when the economy is at its lowest ebb. These kind of policies and opinions tend to be on the rise, and unfortunately you have an enormous perfect storm in Italy, really, because you have a government completely in crisis, you have an emerging cost of living crisis, COVID, one of the deepest recessions we've seen in quite some time, and parties that are willing to propagate lines that are not just slightly pushing the boat out on immigration, but are providing some of the harshest turns on immigration Italy has seen, certainly within the last 70, 80 years.
Yeah, and I think one more final point I would like to add is that in recent years, we've often seen Italy, instead of a left-right political divide, but a technocratic populist change in government. So if you recall the earlier bit of the 2010s, for example, we had Berlusconi seeing, you know, protests against him, his government falling due to public discontent. In comes a technocratic government led by Mario Monti, and then we saw a swing to the other side of politics. So that was, in the case, Enrico Letta, who is now the leader of the Democratic Party, being sworn in as prime minister after the day. Now, what we have seen in recent years is that, don't forget, Giuseppe Conte, although nominally independent, he was allied to the major five-star movement. We then had a technocratic prime minister, and now we're seeing a swing to the other side. So we had, you know, Giuseppe Conte, which is probably a centrist government, but now we could see a very right-wing populist government. So it is a big swing I've noticed in recent years between, instead of left to the right, which long dominated Italian politics, we're now seeing this technocratic populist. And I think that is kind of because frustration with Italian politics, populists coming to government, but yet they can't get anything done. There is not much ideological order that has united the party, so they break apart. A technocrat, Italians then want stability, so a technocrat comes in, but then realizes the problem with technocrats is that they can't promise everything the people want. So it seems to be that is how the fault lies in Italian politics, isn't it? A two-sided summary.
Yeah, I mean, Brothers of Italy have obviously gone on quite a meteoric rise in the last 4 years. They were not really a major factor in any way in the 2018 general election and are now projected by pretty much every opinion poll to be heading for certainly a victory in terms of having the most, the highest vote share in the upcoming election in a few weeks' time. What do you think has caused that meteoric rise? Where has it come from?
Yeah, I think that is let's examine Brothers of Italy a bit more. I mean, the name Brothers of Italy comes from the Italian national anthem, and if you trace its roots. And the Brothers of Italy does have roots with Benito Mussolini, who, of course, was the infamous Italian dictator throughout World War II. I have a stat for you, Stan, but I think can help explain this. We've had when was the last time and that in an Italian election in which the party that won the most number of votes then won the next election, i.e. came first again? Do you know when?
I don't actually, because I don't think it's particularly recent.
Well, you're right. It has definitely not been recent. In fact, it's not happened since we've been born, because the last time that happened was in 1992 with the Christian Democratic Party. Since then, in every election, we've had a different party come first. And I think that is part of the problem, is that Italians are just shopping around, but they shopped around for many years between the Democratic Party and Forza Italia or whatever incarnation of the center-right. And clearly, they have felt that, I think, a large part that their living standards or their standard of living has not been improved. And so that, I think that's encouraged the rise of populism. And I think what has really propelled this rise is the fact that Giorgio Meloni took a very strategic decision not to follow the Liga in particular and go into this unity government. She stood outside it. Therefore, she was able to reap the benefits. So when Italians undeniably got frustrated with the government over numerous issues, the continued infighting that took place, and Meloni would say, could always blame them and say, look at me, I'm a fresh new face. Because she really is a fresh new face in Italian politics as well. She did serve a small period in government. She was youth minister from when Silvio Berlusconi was last time as prime minister from 2008 to 2011. She was the youngest ever minister in Italian history at that point. And I think she has benefited from this widespread frustration and the Brothers of Italy, like you said, coming out of nowhere as powers alternated between the Democratic Party and the Forza Italia over the last 20 years. And she's been able to come out of the fall and really take over. And you cannot deny that Giorgio Meloni herself has moderated the Brothers of Italy, because like I said, this is a party that came out of the neo-fascist fascism of Benito Mussolini. She has said in recent days that she will follow the Draghi debt reduction plan and continue providing Ukraine support, which is particularly significant for a party that was long considered to be pro-Putin until the 24th of February. And she's also, I think, symbolically taken up presidency of the European Conservative and Reformers and not allied themselves with the far-right groups within the European Parliament. She has often talked about the admiration for the UK Conservatives rather than the far-right Marine Le Pen. So I think all this has sort of brought the Brothers of Italy to be more palatable to the general population, akin to Marine Le Pen. And I don't forget the Italian electoral system, which being more populist and more fragmented, meant that somebody with 20-odd% opinion poll ratings could come first and therefore prime minister.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think the key to this revival, really, in the last 4 years in particular, has been because for a notable period in the last couple of years, they have been the only major opposition group, which has given them completely free rein to criticise COVID policy, criticising the alliance of all parties, including the League, aligning themselves up to Mario Draghi as well, and has given them a free run of the airwaves to criticise the government when other parties, such as La Liga, who broadly share a lot of their policy platforms, have been bound by being part of Mario Draghi's technocratic government in a way that the Brothers of Italy just haven't. And when you have a country that is 74% Catholic, when you are parading pro-family messages almost exclusively alone, that has resonance. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Brothers of Italy are doing so well so quickly, is because they've had that free run of coverage to criticize the government and being the only major player doing so.
I think you're absolutely right there. And I think as well that time to suit it Giorgio Meloni, because all throughout Europe, we have seen a backlash against incumbent governments. Incumbent governments being thrown out as cost of living issues really bite. And I think Giorgio Meloni in some ways will be the next incarnation, even though her likely coalition partners in Liga and Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia have both been in the government itself. And I just wonder how Matteo Salvini is feeling right now, because he went into the government and yet he was a populist firebrand in the right-wing populist firebrand in the 2018 election, but has been completely overshadowed in the last term in government and in this election itself. I wonder, in times of change, how that is. I wonder how you must be feeling right now?
No, I mean, for sure. I think that La Liga were positioned, even up to about 2 or 3 years ago, to be the heir apparent to the Italian government. And yet, they're projected to potentially finish fourth in this election with the late surge of the five-star movement. So I think he will be feeling slightly disappointed that what used to be the bastion of the far right in Italy is now lumped with the establishment and is being directly criticised by someone who pretty much shares every policy platform that he was that he brought to the fore in Italian politics back in 2018 and in the immediate aftermath of that election as well.
And I think that also shows me one thing about Italian politics, which is very much personality driven, because it's harder to keep people enthralled around a personality than to keep people enthralled around a policy position. So for example, voters are very sticky in the UK because they are very much Labour supporters of the centre-left and centre-right, and they attach themselves to certain ideologies. It's really hard to attach yourself, particularly in a system in which you're very frustrated by personalities. And Giorgio Meloni now is a bright new thing in Italian politics. In 2018, it was Matteo Salvini and a five-star movement. Now, 4 years later, it's moved on to somebody else. And I think, Sam, it's fascinating, this election, and we're not talking about the party that came first last time around, which is the Five Star Movement. What happened to them, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I remember I looked a lot into the Five Star Movement when they were first coming to the fore in Italian politics back in 2015, 2016. And one of the big things that was cited as a potential risk of the group is that because they selected candidates through online forums, they would accept submissions from all over the Italian economy. They didn't have to have political experience. They didn't even necessarily need to be particularly ideologically aligned. Well, this was always going to be a risk when they were in government, because it was just rank disorganization and a party of such disparate backgrounds and ideologies that just simply could not hold together. I mean, an astounding statistic, I think, is that they started in 2018 with 227 deputies and 112 senators. By February of this year, they had 157 deputies and 62 senators. So they had 70 defections in the House of Chamber of Deputies and 50 defections in the Senate, which is unbelievable. And they joined all sorts of parties. I mean, the first few defections went more to Forza Italia. You've had recent defections to the Communists and to the left party Free and Equal, and more recently to the Brothers of Italy. So this is not a party that has disintegrated into one side of the political spectrum. It's disintegrated all over the place, which to me says everything you need to know about where the party was as a united bloc when it won the election in 2018. I think it was held together by one thing only, which was the fact that it was part of the government. And as soon as it wasn't leading the government, everything just began to fall apart, really. And I think that's what went wrong, because people have seen them in government and have thought, oh, I'm not really sure we want a repeat of that, because it's led to a profound government crisis. And I think their populist reputation has just been taken over by the Brothers of Italy. Even though the Five Star Movement would market themselves as centrist populists, I think they just no longer hold that mantle at all.
Yeah, so I think you're absolutely right there. And I think it really does show that Five Star Movement is a populist party. Although I find the whole concept of centrist populism interesting, because we often associate populism with the far left and the far right. But this is really a unique case of populism being in the center. And I think populism in the center means that you can attract, thanks to, you know, innovative new ways of e-democracy in a way, and, you know, and people and general frustrations of people from the far left and the far right coming together. But then in government, when you implement actions, your then natural ideologies of people come to the fore. And, you know, populism often is an anti-establishment feel to it. So you rail against the system. And that means when you're in government, you're then automatically a lot of times against what you've been fighting for for the last year or two, and therefore the chances of it about disintegrating is high. And therefore it means that when the MPs start defecting, it means that they can defect all over the place, probably in sometimes back to where they were originally from, be it the far right, the center right, the center left, and the far left. And speaking of the center left, the fact that we haven't talked about it suggests that there really are not really identity in this election, really. So how do you rate what's going to happen to them and what has happened to them more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, it would surprise me immensely if the centre-left end up being a major player after this election in terms of their results or in terms of being part of the government, because I just don't think the numbers are there for the centre-left to be able to collectively form a government. And it would seem unbelievably unlikely to me that the centre-left will talk to the Brothers of Italy, La Liga, about forming a government. So I think the chances of them being in government after this election are slim. And let's just look at the centre-left's campaign, because it's been a disaster from beginning to end. They formed a centre-left alliance early, straight out of the gates when this snap election was called, which has since disintegrated because the Action Party withdrew from the alliance and has now formed their own alliance with Matteo Renzi's party, Italia Viva. So you have two centre-left blocks going to this election with major players in, the Democratic Party, Enrico Letta's party, and then you have the Action Party and Matteo Renzi on another side, who are competing for the same pool of votes. And we know that the context of this election is meaning that the left have quite a limited supply of votes. And when they're not uniting to effectively make that vote as efficient as possible, then I just don't think they're going to be in a position to be able to majorly compete in this election. In fact, the latest seat projection I saw was the Left Alliance having somewhere in the region of 80 seats out of 400, which is just not going to be good enough to be part of the government in any major way. And I think that's why we haven't talked about them. And that's why they're not really going to be a major player going into this election, because this environment was going to mean they had to be efficient with their vote. And by not being united and by having two blocks which are competing for effectively the same pool of voters is just not going to make that possible.
Yeah, and I think as well, just to add on to that, is that what we see is that during the start of the campaign, there was a lot of talk about the centre-left forming alliances to keep the far right out. Because let's be frank, the rise of the Brothers of Italy party has been around for quite a while. We could see in the opinion polls, even before the snap election was called, that they were in first place or very close to first place, but yet they still failed to get each other together. You know, there was talk with the Five Star Movement and that, you know, descended into acrimony. You know, Italia Viva, which is led by Matteo Renzi, he himself is a former leader of the Democratic Party, but yet he's not been brought in the fold, having been brought into the fold a little bit earlier on in the campaign. And I think this process of infighting compared to discipline on the right wing, which is very clear that, okay, we know that we will be we have disseminated a way of who's going to be prime minister, and the center right force Italian and Liga know it's going to be Giorgio Meloni. But yet during this election campaign, they've been disciplined. We've not had the same bout of fighting on the center left because they know that their prize is within sight, and it has been in sight for probably quite a long period of time. And so therefore, even within the seat allocation, it's reflected in the fact that the Brothers of Italy are fighting in the most constituencies. I believe it's 98 compared to Liga 70s and Forza Italia, even smaller. They know what is needed to get into power in this election. The centre-left right now is just in a complete disarray. So, and voters, having seen the infighting that led to the fall of the Draghi government, is probably asking themselves, well, if I vote for the centre-left, I'm probably voting for more of the infighting. So why on earth should I do that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. And so given all that, Chern, as we always do, predictions for a few weekends' time.
Yeah, I think that is going to be relatively a bit more straightforward. I think the Brothers of Italy will be winning this election. They will form the next prime minister. I think the question I ask is whether the centre-right coalition itself can command a majority in both chambers. And right now I'm leaning towards they will be able to do that. And I think, well, that will make governing arrangements a little bit easier. As I'm sure you're going to tell me, Sam, how many Italian prime ministers has there been since Queen Elizabeth had been on the throne? And as a result, Whether Giorgio Meloni can survive as prime minister over this next term will be anybody's guess based on the last 5 years, isn't it?
Yeah, so I was doing a bit of digging into how many prime ministers of various countries Queen Elizabeth's reign has seen. Italy, the answer to prime ministers is 30. But, Chern, how many governments have been formed in that time?
Well, I genuinely do not know the answer to that question. So I imagine it must be a big number more than that, isn't it?
62 governments have been formed in Her Majesty the Queen's 70-year reign, 30 prime ministers, and I think we're about to see the 63rd since 1952 and the 31st prime minister. But who that will be, I guess we'll have to wait a few weekends to see. But I agree with your prediction. I think the Brothers of Italy are going to win this election and they're probably going to be in charge of the government. I mean, the electoral system is key here because it favours parties who can be effective on the constituency level and also amass a sizable amount of the votes in the proportional level, because it's not a levelling proportional in the same way like Germany is, for example. It's just there are 147 constituencies and then the rest of the seats, the 245 in multi-member national proportional seats, are just allocated on the proportion of that vote. It doesn't matter how many single constituencies you won. Therefore, the centre-right, I think, will be in a good position to be able to form a majority, or not far off an outright majority in this election. And it's just going to mean that the outcome of this election is exactly what we were all expecting the outcome to be, basically since last year, before we even knew this election was going to take place.
Yeah, and we talk about other prime ministers throughout this tenure. Take a guess how many Peruvian prime ministers have there been throughout Her Majesty the Queen's reign?
I mean, you did tell me this fact, which I thought was incredible, but I'll let you, I won't take your limelight.
Well, it is 70. So in other words, one prime minister for every year that Her Majesty has been on the throne. So, well, I'm afraid Italy doesn't quite take the crown on this occasion, but it did come awfully close, isn't it? And on that note, that is it for this episode of Ballot to Talk About. Do join us again next week when we'll be previewing upcoming elections in Latvia and giving a rundown of results in Sweden. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at @ballot_talk. And do leave us a rating or review, or simply tell your friends about us. And before I would like to end on this episode, on my behalf, let me pass our deepest condolences to Her Majesty the Queen from the rest of the Commonwealth as a citizen in a Commonwealth country. My name is Chen Han, and until next time, we will speak to you soon.